Joining me now is Patricia T. O'Connor, author of a number of books on the English language. Woe is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, most recently a book for kids called Woe is I, Junior. And when she visits us, we take your calls at 212-433-9692. We'll be getting to the calls in a little while. But, Pat, one of the things that comes up constantly on the show is the way different people pronounce words and what it tells us about those people. You've talked about your Midwestern roots and how that has affected some of your pronunciations.
Correct. That's why I have perfectly unaccented English.
Do you?
Whereas you, for example, no, I'm joking, but often the way we speak does help identify our origins. And often I get asked, where does the extra R come from when people in certain areas of the Northeast say, want a drink of soda or think of an idea?
It's interesting that those same people are likely to drop the R in words that end with E-R. They'll say
yes.
Rockefeller.
Yes, and those tendencies are related. They're exactly entwined. And how this comes about is that people who drop their R's in some places will reinsert them someplace else. Now, take a word like better. Often in the Northeast, you'll hear it pronounced betta. Mm-hmm. Or far, you'll hear it pronounced fa. And the R will not be inserted unless that word comes in front of a vowel. So, for example, someone might say, he got a better deal, but he's better off.
Or, Roth.
Boston isn't far, but Boston isn't far away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the R is inserted between two what for them are vowel sounds. And then these same people will add the R to words that end in an a sound before a vowel because, once again, they're inserting an R between two vowel sounds. So they'll say, for instance, take idea. They might say, that idea stinks, but that idea annoys me. So that's really the same pattern for them, putting the R in between two vowel sounds. And some speakers will go even farther and pronounce idea and soda as idea and soda even at the end of a sentence.
Now, it can also be in the middle of a word because,
yes,
although I don't do this, I have been known to say neighborhood.
Uh-huh. Right. That's that same tendency. It's just not at the end of a word.
Well, it's okay for me because it's in the middle of a word.
Right.
And so I don't notice it.
Correct. But, you know, speaking of soda, you can always tell a Minnesotan by the way he or she pronounces the word soda. Now, the O sound is almost like an oo. They'll say soda, 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 soda. And that kind of speech that you hear in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and parts of the Dakotas is sometimes called Minnewegian, the Minnewegian accent.
Isn't it similar to the Canadian about?
Yes, it is. Yes. Often that those same Minnewegians, when they move on, they take that accent with them. For instance, into Canada or into Alaska, for example, which is why Sarah Palin has traces of the Minnewegian accent. A lot of the Minnewegian pioneers went on to settle in Alaska.
Mm.
So she has a tendency to sound like a Minnesotan.
I was wondering.
Mm-hmm.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. There are things that are unique to New York, and I assume that some of them come from the immigrants who came here. I don't know whether
yes.
this R dropped and added R comes from immigrants, but some of the other things that used to be associated with New York, I don't think mm-hmm. anybody says toity-toit anymore, but that was part of the Irish accent.
Yes, and the Yiddish has contributed to the what we think of as the New York accent, Italian strains, Irish, they've all combined into what is really a unique way of speaking. And a lot of people, when they write to me about this kind of thing, they talk about mispronunciations. And these aren't mispronunciations. They're regional accents. And I think they're part of what makes American speech so colorful and so interesting. Now, we here in the United States find a certain charm in, say, the Southern accent, the New York accent, the whatever. In other countries, accents are not so tolerated. For instance, in France, if you don't speak like a Parisian, you may be looked down upon a little.
In England, it's the clue as to your class.
Exactly.
In fact, to many different things. It can tell people, as we saw in My Fair Lady or Pygmalion, that you came from this town, in fact, this part of this town in the middle of England.
Right, right. I think, I'm not sure, but I seem to recall that Professor Higgins was actually modeled on a real person who was an early phonologist. But it's a fascinating subject. And I think the people who do that kind of work find a great richness in American speech.
There are people who will tell you where you come from in New York City based on the way you pronounce words. I defy them. And I have not changed. In the first grade, Miss Samani said to the class, "Listen to the way Leonard speaks. He speaks correctly." The kids hated me from that moment on.
Oh, my goodness. What a thing to do to you.
Yeah. I've never recovered. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Patricia T. O'Connor is my guest. We're taking your calls on the English language. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Should we take some calls?
Yes.
Okay. Let's go to Corey. Corey from Manhattan. Let me see. Okay. Hi, Corey. You're on the air.
Hi. What's happening to gender in our language? Have all the women disappeared? Where did all the actresses go? They morphed into actors. The heroines morphed into heroes. The gals seem to have morphed into guys. is this just the language being dumbed down by people that can't tell the difference between men and women? Or is it, you know, is it some kind of gender equality that all the hens are going to turn into drakes?
Oh, please.
Now, is there something that bothers you about calling a woman an actor?
Well, I would think that within reason, just about any actor can play any male role, but except for trouser roles, can...
But wait. How far do you want this to go? People used to talk about Jewesses and Negresses, et cetera. And I think that...
Aviatrixes.
Yeah,
no,
aviatrix.
Wait a second.
And I can think of some other words I don't want to say on the air that had those endings.
Wait a second. For example, when somebody said Jewess, it wasn't that a Jew was only a male. It was some kind of a goofy diminutive.
No, it wasn't. It was simply saying that she was a female Jew.
Okay, she's saying a female Jew, but there was no... It's not like a drake is the only kind of duck. You know, and a hen.
They don't even make good cake, those Drake people.
I mean,
well, Pat, what's your take on that?
My opinion is that there's no reason to say woman doctor, actress, lady professor, aviatrix, or any of that. If you're identifying a person by profession, you shouldn't assume that the generic word is by default the male version. That's how I feel.
And that's becoming more and more the case?
Having best actress in the Oscars, that makes sense.
To distinguish it from the male winner.
Correct. Otherwise, I don't see any point to it. Poetess, you know, authoress. I think we've outgrown that.
We thank you for your call. And now Martin from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I don't know if this is an answerable question, but I was an enthusiastic watcher of this John Adams teleplay they had on HBO.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that if everyone came to this country with an English accent, how did 100 years later the Southerners start saying y'all? And they sound like Southerners,
actually,
and people from Boston sound like people from Boston.
You have a misapprehension there. We didn't lose... We didn't have a British accent that we lost. The British once spoke pretty much with a generic American accent. The speech of 18th century Englishmen was pretty much the way we speak now. They acquired characteristics of what we think of as the British accent between roughly 1790 and 1820. For instance, the dropped R, the broad A, saying past instead of past, dropping syllables, secretary instead of secretary.
Yes.
All those were later traits. They used to speak the way we do.
And we know that because when, for example, when Shakespeare does rhymes, they are really more American rhymes than modern British rhymes.
Exactly. And we also know that because people wrote about it a lot at the time. Keats was greatly criticized, for example, for rhyming the word fawn, F-A-W-N, with thorn, which meant he was pronouncing it thawn. And critics jumped all over him in England for dropping his R in that. And for there were pronouncing dictionaries of the day. There were elocution guides. They all show that they spoke pretty much with an American accent. So we've preserved the way English speech was 200 or 300 years ago. It's the British that changed. And if that Adams documentary had been more authentic, they might have spoken with American accents.
The British soldiers.
Yes.
How does that explain the southern a southern accent versus a Boston accent versus a New York accent?
Well, right. Once the colonies broke off from Britain, our speech diversified as the population spread out. And, of course, that's pretty much what had already happened in Britain. Everyone doesn't sound like a Londoner.
But also, I think, supposedly people from different parts of England went to different parts of the colonies. But I would
think
that the reason that for many years British actors were really good playing southern roles, mm-hmm. like Gone with the Wind, for example,
right.
which had a number of major English actors, is because the accents aren't all that different. And when we
That's
think of
right.
a Boston accent, it's because the Irish and other people came in and probably affected that accent
Correct.
Later.
Correct. But phonologists also think that people on the East Coast, in the South, and in, say, Boston, they may have acquired some of these new characteristics of British speech because of their closeness with Britain through trade, cultural ties, and whatnot. They were more exposed to the newly developed British accent than other Americans were.
What I want to know about is how did Keats and Yeats wind up being pronounced so differently? Both great poets.
Yes.
One letter changes everything.
Yes, I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, I was hoping you would clear that
I'm
up
sorry.
For me, Pat. Barbara from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. This is just in reference to something Ms. O'Connor said at the top of the session in referring to regional differences in the insertion of the R at vowel-ending words. She said some people take it farther, and I'm questioning the use of farther. It may have just been a slip. One of my earliest memories from college on grammar correction, was the following. You use further in referring to dimension and farther when you're referring to distance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become something I've been a real stickler for in my undergraduate teaching. And I was wondering if two words have become blurred, if there is no longer any real distinction between further and farther.
Right.
And
if I had been reading a script that I'd written, I would have said further, because I agree with you. That's how I use the words, that further means degree and farther means physical or metaphorical distance.
Now, there's a hymn, Father Along, and it has often been distorted in other versions as Father Alone.
Oh, that's interesting. Rather like a Mondegreen.
People heard what they heard.
Uh-huh, right.
And you're hearing Patricia T. O'Connor on the Leonard LoPage Show. We're going to take a little break, and we'll come back with more of your calls to 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our comment line on our show page at WNYC.org.
words. Oh, what I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And what I feel in my heart, they say sincerely. No other words can tell it half so clearly. Three little words.
We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, Yosemite, Woe Is I Jr. Pat, don't write any more books. I don't know if I can remember all the
time. Too late.
During this election cycle, we've been hearing the name Roosevelt invoked an awful lot, both Teddy and FDR.
Uh-huh.
And it got me thinking about the phrase bully pulpit, which used to be invoked a lot. We talk about the president using the bully pulpit. We haven't heard that very much, maybe because George Bush doesn't use the bully pulpit very much. But it's always struck me as an odd phrase.
Well, interestingly, I recently got a question from a listener about bully pulpit. He was a little bit surprised that he was seeing it used, the expression, to mean a public position that lets one bully people, to be a bully. And actually, that's not the way it was intended at all. In 17th century England, bully was an adjective used to describe people who were jolly or admirable or worthy in some way. And in mid-19th century America, we widened the meaning of that word to just mean anything first rate. For instance, that was a bully dinner we had, or that was a bully attack on the Redcoats or something like that. And or bully for you just meant a good job. And Teddy Roosevelt just happened to use that adjective once in an interview. An interviewer was speaking with him, and Roosevelt said, "I suppose my critics will call that preaching, but I have got such a bully pulpit." And he meant such a fabulous pulpit, meaning the presidency is an ideal pulpit from which to influence people. That's how he meant it. And now we're finding once in a while people using it to mean a pulpit from which you bully people.
Well, they're being literal.
Right, right. Yeah, so anyway, I find that sometimes when a political season rolls around, our thinking gets a little woolly.
A listener, Carla in Inwood, would like to know whether the original Dutch immigrants to New York have influenced the way we speak as well. Since I'm thinking about the Roosevelts.
I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know. I'm actually not a phonologist myself, but I wouldn't be surprised at that.
I always wondered whether a phonologist is somebody who also uses the phone.
No doubt they do.
With the iPhone, we're getting people doing all sorts of phonology these days.
Yeah.
We go now to Yoshi from Fort Lee, New Jersey. Hi, Yoshi.
Oh, hi. Good morning, Leonard.
It's the afternoon. It's probably morning in Japan, Yoshi, but...
Well, I'm Japanese-American. I wouldn't know. Just to get back to what the previous caller or listeners asked about the Dutch influence, I was always told that when New Yorkers use this and that, you know, the D's in the beginning of the TH words, that's apparently influenced from the Dutch. I don't know if it's true, but I've heard it, you know, referenced before. But, you know, my question
very likely.
My question is about how foreign words get integrated into our language, specifically who gets to make those decisions. I've always wondered, you know, for instance, how words like karaoke get, you know, included in the dictionary. You know, is it turned into a verb or a noun? And I've noticed that lately there's, you know, a new word that's being used a lot. It's called bukkake. Have you heard about this?
Bukkake? No, what does it mean?
I thought that he ran for president against Bush. Are you still there? I guess he just suddenly disappeared.
Well, I can answer the question more or less. When a foreign word becomes very common and it's on everyone's tongue, and we start seeing and hearing it everywhere, lexicographers doing the job that they're supposed to do, think about putting it in dictionaries. And when a foreign word first enters the dictionary, it'll be identified as a foreignism, and eventually it will just become standard English.
Because English is one of the most all-embracing languages in the world.
Exactly. We tend to take in strays.
Pajamas. Orange, I understand, comes from the... There was no word for orange until naranja came into the English
language. It once started with an N when it first entered the language, naranj. And because of people saying, naranj, it became an orange.
And then that became the name of the color.
Yes,
which at that point, there was no name for that color. It was either reddish yellow or or yellowish red.
Yeah. We didn't call it pumpkin at the time. but you're right, yes.
So the English language has done this. Wherever we go, we wind up picking up words.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it actually, and we sure have picked up a lot of French words.
Yes, we have. We have partly the Norman Conquest to thank for that.
But ballet came after the Norman Conquest.
Yes.
Garage, all sorts of words
Cuisine,
like that.
Cuisine, all those things have influenced us.
We go now to Anne from Manhattan. Hi, Anne, you're on the air.
Hi. What about William of Orange? How does that fit in? You know, the that lead away back.
You mean, why was he called William of Orange?
Yeah, I mean, where does that fit in?
Because he wasn't Eric the Red. What do you think?
you're a pip.
I think that identified the, was it the Orange Free State?
Yes.
Or what he
it was the Orange Free State.
Yeah.
Now, I guess Anne's question is, was the Orange Free State named that before we started using the Spanish word for orange? I don't know.
Somebody's
going to have to do a little little study on that.
Yes.
If you have an OED.
My question. I have a real question.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I was reading the other day, and I came across the expression wood drum. Now, shouldn't that have been wooden drum? Isn't wood a noun and wooden an adjective?
Wood is the noun, wooden is the adjective, but wood is also used as an adjective.
It is.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
It's not, that's not uncommon.
Uh-huh.
That's one of the characteristics of English, that we do tend to, we tend to widen and nouns become adjectives as well as nouns, and separate adjectives come along. So,
by the way, I once heard that very fancy socialites in the 30s and some of our politicos would use the expression 33rd, and it was supposed to be a fancy way of speaking. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
33rd? In the 1930s.
No.
Yeah.
Haven't.
Okay.
Thank you for calling.
Does that ring a bell with you?
I don't know what 33rd means. You mean toity-toid?
33rd. They was somehow. Okay. Thank
don't
you.
Know.
Well, maybe some listener knows. We go now to John from New Jersey. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're okay.
I was just wondering about the accent of William F. Buckley Jr., and which sounds kind of British, but a little bit affected. How would he have acquired such an unusual accent, being born and raised in the northeastern United States?
Well, in many parts of the Northeast that had a lot of commerce with the British in the 19th century after they formed their accent, those parts of the country did take on some of those characteristics. I don't know if you remember the movies of the 30s with the Philadelphia mainliners, the Grace Kelly, Katharine Hepburn characters, they all had almost approaching a British accent, and it was because of the British influence.
I remember Julia Child used to pronounce the word H-E-R-B, herb, which is the way the British pronounce it.
They do now, although they only picked up that pronunciation relatively recently. The word was originally herb, and it was pronounced that way in Shakespeare's day, and it acquired an H, I believe, in the early 19th century. Herb.
So thank you for calling, but the point that I was trying to make is I think that people who considered themselves cultured or came out of a certain kind of a cultural background
exactly.
pronounced words, often with the British pronunciation.
Yes, yes, they do.
And I'm not sure whether it was ever seen as pretentious to say "ask" instead of "ask." We got a comment on a comment line from someone in Manhattan who points out that you didn't say why the British started speaking with a different accent after 1790. do we know?
Better people than I know the answer. I think it had something to, I know it started in high social circles in London in the 1790s, maybe the late 1780s. And I have read, but I haven't done a lot of research on the why of this, but I have read that it was an attempt on the part of the upper classes to distance themselves from lower-class Londoners, the Cockney accents.
Not just in that way. There are all of those words like Chumley, which is about chowl, whatever.
Cholmondeley.
it was all a way of saying that we are an elite and we know the secret code.
Mm-hmm. Right. It was
a code. It grows out of the class system.
Yeah.
In this country, we don't have a class system. That's why everyone speaks the same, right?
Thank heavens they don't.
We go now to, is it Parlin?
Yes.
From Manhattan. Hi, Parlin. You're on the air.
Just to follow up on what you were saying, what I had heard is that the accent changed when a German man married into the royal family, and he had trouble with English pronunciation, and so everybody adapted his limitations, dropping the R and Thames, pronouncing that Thames.
Of course, there were German-born. There was a German-born king at the time of the American Revolution.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason that I called is I was fascinated to hear that you have always spoken this way, Leonard, because when I've heard you talking to your brother on the show, he has a much stronger New York accent, and you sound as if almost you came from two different families.
Oh, we did, actually.
Uh-huh.
No, I have no idea why.
Yeah.
He's the younger brother.
Uh-huh. I thought maybe it's because you were in radio and you had changed your speech.
No.
My sister and I had very different ways of speaking. She died last year, but she sounded much more Midwestern than I do.
Uh-huh.
So there you go.
Well, my mother came from Boston. And she spoke with a Bostonian accent, and I think when I was a kid, I picked up some of that. And as time went on, my mother became more and more of a New Yorker, and she, or perhaps a New Yorker, and her accent became much more mixed.
So by the time your brother came along, he was emulating a different...
Well, he just grew up in a slightly different environment, but who knows? These are complicated questions, and I prefer not to ask those questions. I want to point out also that, by the way, before we end this, that Pat O'Connor can be reached by email. In fact, you can email her directly at mailbox@grammarphobia.com. Although, please learn how to spell the word grammar, because a bunch of that stuff gets bounced back to the... I sent her an email at Grammarphobia, and I couldn't get through. Well, it's because grammar is a hard word to spell, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one word, grammarphobia.com. And you can also just go to grammarphobia.com and click on Pat's blog to see a selection of language questions from WNYC's listeners. Are you still inundated?
I am, but, you know, oddly, since you moved to your new studio, I don't seem to get as many as from the old studio.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know.
We haven't lost any ratings points that I know of. Well, that's like the question about why my brother and I have different accents. Who knows the answers to these things? Let's try to get another call or two in here. Craig from Manhattan, how you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I'll be quick. I keep hearing that the word soul, S-O, used as an article, a preposition, a conjunctive. And I was taught that using the word soul was poor grammar and poor English usage. And once the guy who wrote the book Freakonomics was on either your show or Brian's show, and
he's been on both of our shows.
And he, I swear, every answer to every question, the first word was, so you're asking me if this is that. So you're saying is that that.
Well, I've also seen it with a lot of scientists, actually. They say, so the xylem meets the phloem.
I always thought it was a synonym for therefore, or either it was a preposition. And I'm just wondering,
what
is the proper use?
I think most of the time it's an adverb, but... as far as whether it's incorrect to do that, it's not incorrect, but I laughed a moment ago because I've gotten several emails from listeners about this. They'll say, why is it interviewers will start out by saying, so, da-da-da-da-da, and then the guest will respond, so, blah, blah, blah. and I think it's a filler kind of thing. It's a stalling tactic.
We can't stall anymore because we've run out of time, but Pat O'Connor will be back with us on November 19th. And if you want to find out her email address, in case you didn't write it down, you can just go to our show page at WNYC.org, and we have it listed there. And Pat, thank you for being here again. It's always such a pleasure to have you as a guest on the show.
Thank you for having me.